Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Dennis against Sparks and Lynn. Edmonds, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the points that petitioner feels are presented to the court on this petition for certiorari have to do with the question of whether a state court judge acting within the scope of his jurisdiction is a person, as that term or word is used in section 1983. Petitioner submits that the resolution of that question depends in great part upon the scope of judicial immunity as that concept is applied by this court.
Isn't immunity an affirmative defense?
Judicial immunity, Your Honor, petitioner submits, is more than an affirmative defense.
Yeah. You mean it has a little bit of jurisdiction in it?
Your Honor, in examining the development of judicial immunity, it seems that an argument can be made that it's in the rationale behind judicial immunity, the public interest to be served by judicial immunity, to put it in terms that is judicial immunity an affirmative defense raises the question, what if the judge who sued doesn't raise the defense?
Well, are you suggesting that it's comparable to, analogous to, the posture of a United States senator under the speech or debate clause, that he may not be required and it may not be questioned in any other place?
I'm saying that it's analogous to legislative immunity, congressional immunity under the speech or debate clause, if the purpose for questioning the judge or for suing the judge is because of his act or conduct while a judge acting within his jurisdiction.
But we don't have a speech or debate clause type for judges, do we?
No, Your Honor.
That's a judicially constructed.
It's a common law construction. Yes, Your Honor. And if the scope of judicial immunity, just going back to Bradley versus Fisher, and throughout the cases that have been decided by this court, Pearson, Embler, more recently in the Consumer Union case, the analysis of legislative immunity, the analysis of judicial immunity, that if the public interest or rationale behind this immunity is to free the judge from the intimidations, harassment, et cetera, as the court has many times discussed in these cases, if that is the rationale, then rhetorically, does not the rationale require that judicial immunity apply regardless of whether the judge raises it as a defense? So in answer to your question, Judge Rehnquist, I would say that it's more than an affirmative defense, as would be a qualified immunity, where a state officer or a federal officer is asserting that he is immune because of his good faith carrying out of discretionary functions.
Well, what if served with a complaint in an action such as this and simply lets the time for answer go by and a default judgment is taken against him? Would you say that judgment is no good?
Uh,
Or he answers.
Yes.
Or he answers and litigates the case without ever raising the claim the judgment is against him. Is that judgment good?
Petitioner's position is that judicial immunity, that the public interest behind judicial immunity is that it's not in the judge's discretion to raise the question of judicial immunity. That it's the adjudicating court's function to apply it. It's a matter of jurisdiction.
So even if he said, I want to answer this on the merits and clear my name of these allegations in the complaint, he would not be permitted to do so under your...
Well, Your Honor, my response to that is, does that not raise the question or beg the issue about the underlying rationale for the immunity? Is it up to the judge to decide whether he wants to respond or not? Or is it in the public interest that he not respond?
Because
how does that place the judge?
In your submission, it's a matter almost of jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. Because if one judge agrees that, okay, I will participate in this lawsuit, I won't raise my affirmative defense of judicial immunity, and I'll go in there and we'll straighten this thing out. Well, what about all the other judges? What about the public interest behind judicial immunity?
What could you do about it? What could you or anybody else do about it?
What could my client do about it?
What could you or anybody else do if a judgment is obtained against Judge Joe Bloke, who never told anybody that he was a judge and never raised a question? Now, what could anybody do about it?
Well,
nothing.
Well, Your Honor, they'd know he was a judge.
Nothing. So it's not jurisdictional.
Well, if the man were sued for conduct while not carrying out his judicial function, I would agree.
Well,
but if he's being sued because of carrying out his judicial function, we know he's a judge.
Then it's not jurisdictional, then, is it?
Yes, it is.
The fact that if you sue him as John Jones and he happens to be a judge, what would happen?
Why am I suing him for carrying out his judicial function or for...
For just what he did here. And you didn't mention that he was a judge.
I would say that the public interest requires that the reviewing court apply judicial immunity and say that this judge is immune because he was acting as a judge when he did what he alleged to have done.
Well, let's assume. Can't we start with an assumption that this judge is immune and go on to your client who is not a judge, is he?
That's right, Your Honor. He's not a judge.
Yeah. Okay.
And how can my client raise the...
Vicarious exemption, if it is an exemption.
Right. My client's position is that, like the Barrow versus Jackson case that involved the defendant who had sold property in violation of a restrictive covenant to folks of another race, the question was, could that defendant raise the constitutionality of that restrictive covenant as it applied to the other race to whom the defendant sold? And this court held yes. In Griswold versus Connecticut, there the physician had been convicted of a crime of an accessory, and an accomplice to third parties having to do with the state's ban on contraceptions. And this court held that the physician had standing to raise the constitutionality argument that was more directly applicable to the third parties, the persons for whom the physician had treated.
That's a matter of those cases really turn on standing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's the right to of one person to raise the interests or the rights of jus tertii, the rights of a third person. Is that what this is, a standing case, kind of?
Well.
Not exactly.
No. I mention those because I think they're applicable. I was thinking, I guess, of the question raised by the amicus, one of the amicus in the case, questioning our ability to raise the judge's immunity because we're not a judge. We were sued by the plaintiffs for participating in a state judicial function. Our first point about the definition of person, the scope of judicial immunity, this to me logically goes into the question about was it congressional intent back in 1866 and again in 1871 and with subsequent amendments to the various civil rights acts, specifically this act, 1893, is it congressional intent to superimpose federal court oversight or federal court jurisdiction over the litigation among parties of private rights under state in the state court authorities? Here we don't have a case of Mr. Dennis and the other parties mugging the respondent on a highway. What we've got here is the other parties who are not before the court right now, having gone to state court, having filed a suit in state court, a temporary injunction having been entered by Judge Carrillo, and that temporary injunction being dissolved in the ordinary course of events in the state proceedings by the Court of Appeals.
What would be your analysis if a United States member of the United States Congress, House or Senate, was involved in a conspiracy with a private citizen, and then the private citizen is a defendant, but not the member of Congress? Do you think the speech or debate clause would carry over to the co-conspirator who was not protected by the speech or debate clause directly?
My answer is yes, Your Honor.
You must say that here, because if it isn't true there, it couldn't possibly be true here, could it be?
I tend to agree, Your Honor.
Something like pendant immunity.
Vicarious immunity.
I'm very reluctant to get into the area of using the terms of immunities, because I can't say that Mr. Dennis had an immunity at common law. I can't say that he had any of the immunities that this court has held were not abrogated by Congress when they passed the civil rights statute we're dealing with. However, I am saying that the public interest, the rationale, the logic behind judicial immunity requires this result. And if we want to call it vicarious or pendant or derivative, so be it. The rationale requires it, as pointed out by the dissent in the en banc decision for the Fifth Circuit, and as pointed out by others. It requires it because
the judge is home free.
The judge is home free, but to allow the he's home free from a liability standpoint. But I guess the answer has to be almost rhetorical. To allow prosecution of the claim against the private citizen conspirator under — how is the private citizen even liable under 1983? It's because of conspiracy with the judge under the Addicts v. Kress. So we've got to have a conspiracy with the judge. So the judge is involved — the judge's interest is involved because of the litigation against the private person. The case is necessarily going to involve whether there was a conspiracy with this judge, even though he's immune, even though he can't be made to participate, even though he can't be made to testify.
What case holds that?
There is no case that holds that, Your Honor. It's petitioner's construction that the concept of judicial immunity requires that the judge not participate. Just as this court recently held or stated in a
judge isn't immune from criminal indictment on the grounds of official immunity.
That's true, Your Honor. But this is a civil case.
Prosecuted.
this judge is in jail, isn't he?
But not for this, Your Honor.
Has Mandis been prosecuted?
To my knowledge, he has not been prosecuted in a state district court for this conduct. He was removed from his office because of conduct, including this conduct. Again,
but he hasn't been prosecuted criminally. Do you know why not?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
You're suggesting this judge couldn't be called as a witness against his co-conspirators?
Well, I'm suggesting that if we say...
He might not even... All right, go ahead.
Well, if we say that public interest requires that judges not be subjected to a pleading contest that can be brought about by any dissatisfied litigant in any state court action, that to say that, okay, immunity means that you can't, that he's entitled to dismissal as a party, and immunity means that you
can't
get a judgment
against him.
Well,
immunity for these people isn't required then to implement any of the policies of giving judges immunity. They can't be bothered for anything. If they can't be called as witnesses, why do you need to give their co-conspirators immunity just to protect the judge? If the judge is already protected by
from being called as a witness or dragged through cases, I thought your argument would be that if you didn't give these people immunity, the judge could be called as a witness and would be involved in this case, be taken away from his judicial duties, and have his motives questioned.
I thought so too. It brought to my mind the controversy between Jefferson and Burr when John Marshall was sitting in the treason trial and tried to get Jefferson to appear as a witness, and I think they settled it by Jefferson simply furnishing papers, and Jefferson's response was, if the president can be subpoenaed from one court to another, he can be prevented from doing his presidential duties. But if you say he can't, that the judge can't even be subpoenaed to testify, it seems to me there's no reason in the policy that Justice White has mentioned to say that the co-conspirators share his immunity.
Between the Burr case and one more recent case, the courts have held that the president must respond and be a witness if necessary.
But again, that was a criminal action, though, was it not, Your Honor?
It happened to be, but if there were civil actions that followed, a fortiori, it would seem clear that they would have to come as witnesses.
Well, petitioner is arguing that there is a distinction between the scope of judicial immunity in a civil action and the scope in a criminal action. I think there are other state or public interests that are floating in that scheme of things. The rationale behind the protections of the system of prosecutors and grand juries and indictments and the state itself, but when you get to the civil action area under Section 1983, you're talking about enforcement, about albeit harassment of judges by private persons. The same constitutional or statutory safeguards don't apply, but I do agree there's a conflict there that I think is resolved by differing public policy interests.
Mr. Edmonds, would there be a state law civil remedy against your clients for the alleged bribery offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
And no immunity claim would defeat that action. You're asking the federal court to grant a broader immunity than the state courts of Texas grant, then, is that right?
There would be judicial immunity with respect to a civil action for the bribery. With respect to a criminal prosecution for the bribery, there would not be.
No, I'm asking about a damage remedy brought by the plaintiffs in this case against the non-judicial defendants in this case, making the same allegations that are made here.
There is a damage remedy, and that remedy is being pursued by the respondent in the form of a wrongful injunction suit. Under Texas law, the dissolution of an injunction creates a cause of action for the wrongful injunction. But in that case, the motives of the judge in entering the injunction is not a critical or turning factor. But here we're talking about how do you get to the private citizen under 1983? You get to him only because of a conspiracy with the state actor. In this case, it's a judge.
Is the judge liable
under Texas law under the wrongful injunction action?
No. Only Mr. Mangus, who was the party that got the injunction, and my client's liability would be limited solely to the bond that he signed.
No, but apart from that action on the bond, is there a tort action in Texas available as a matter of common law for bribing a judge to get him to harm you in some way?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. If that
very well. Mr. Smith?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The question, I think, is pretty well before the court. The question is whether or not the private individuals who do conspire with a state judge and do cause the state judge to enter the bench and enter unlawful orders that result in damage to the plaintiff, do they automatically derive immunity for their wrongdoing simply because the judge is himself immune? Now, this case, of course, is before Your Honors as on the pleadings, on a motion to dismiss. And the pleadings, of course, have to be taken as true. But we would point out to the court that there's nothing in these pleadings, in this case, that has not already been adjudicated in the state of Texas. The bribery was adjudicated in a motion to disqualify Judge Carrillo. The comments of the judge after both parties had rested is included and attached to our pleadings, which is in the appendix. And the order that the judge entered, holding that the judge was disqualified because the transactions between the judge and Mr. Mangus amounted to a disqualifying situation, that's been decided. Now, Judge Correa has subsequently been impeached by the Texas legislature. The House included the transactions involved in the disqualification matter as one of the articles of impeachment. There were 12 articles. But this was only one of them. He was convicted by the Texas Senate and removed from office for corruption, various items. He was later tried and convicted in federal court for tax fraud. Thereafter, he was tried and convicted in Texas state courts for theft. Now, we're not here on a jailhouse-type pleading that's accusing an honorable judge and trying to besmirch the character of an honorable judge who simply made an error in one of his rulings.
One of the reasons for the immunity doctrine is that it's awfully hard to separate out before you go to trial and appeal and so forth the honorable judge who made a mistake in his ruling and the corrupt judge who's been jailed for theft.
I think Learned in Hand addressed that question in one of his decisions. He said that if you could determine that, then it would be monstrous not to allow relief. Now, in this case, that determination has been made. We're not before you.
But it wasn't made at the time you filed your 1983 action, was it?
Oh, yes. It was made then. Now, at the time the wrongful injunction was issued, the attorneys who represented the respondents in that case, which was not our firm, the attorneys who represented the respondents in that case did not know of the bribery. The bribery itself was not determined until May the 20th, 1973. But the judge who made the determination said that because of the bribery, the judge was disqualified as of February 1, 1971. Now, the wrongful injunction came after that date. So the wrongful injunction came after the judge had accepted the bribe and after he was disqualified because of it.
Well, this wasn't the rationale of the Court of Appeals.
How's that?
This isn't the rationale of the Court of Appeals, the en banc decision of the Court of Appeals.
Well, no, sir.
you're going to defend that, aren't you?
Oh, yes, I'm going to address that. The rationale of the Court of Appeals...
I take it you would not agree...
I beg your pardon?
I take it you would not agree with your friend that a co-conspirator with a member of Congress would have the cloak of the speech or debate clause around him.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think... I don't think that is exactly parallel. The congressional immunity is based on a specific constitutional provision. The judicial immunity is based on common law. And you could concede
the former arguendo and still maintain your position.
I would say it's irrelevant to our position. The Civil Rights Act, in dealing with this matter, they did not specifically make an exception. But in approaching our problem, we have to start with the Civil Rights Act, and it, of course, does not make an exception even of the judge. But the court, in construing that statute, concluded that the Congress did not intend to abolish the common law immunities that existed at that time. And immunities did exist for judges. But no immunity existed for those who conspire with judges under common law. So, therefore, the rationale that supports the immunity for the judges does not in any way give any immunity whatever to...
If it's that clear, it's rather strange that most of the courts of appeals have decided it against you.
Your Honor... That was the case when this was first briefed. There have been three circuits that have changed their mind, and the majority of the courts of appeals are now on our side.
Well, the Seventh has changed its mind?
Seventh has changed its mind.
Well, are you sure? Is that from that on?
I construe Lopez versus Vanderwater as...
Was that the en banc... Per curiam, or was that a later one?
No, that's a subsequent case.
That's a later one. All right.
Yeah, this was decided in April.
All right. What other one has changed its mind?
Okay. I would say that the Tenth Circuit in Norton versus Liddell.
Well, that isn't a change of mind.
Well, you're correct. It is not a change in mind, but it is
the addition of another circuit. Tell me another one that's changed its mind. The Fifth has, of course, in this case.
The Fifth has, specifically. And when you add them all up, I would say the circuits that now support our position are the Seventh. Now, I construe that in bank decision. You have to analyze about seven different specific decisions, but when you tabulate the vote, I think they come down pretty hard.
Well, the Ninth is still against you.
So far as I know, they have.
And the Third is still against you.
That's correct.
The Fourth is still against you. The Sixth
Correct.
Is still against you.
That's right. But there you end.
All right. Well, it's about even then, isn't it?
No.
You want to straighten them out. Is that kind of...
I don't think we have
well,
to...
My only point was that there's been an awful lot of courts of appeals that have thought that the policies of judicial immunity required immunity for private parties.
Well, those cases, I say, were not really thought through very much. They weren't presented very well. They were mostly pro se cases. And the court took an easy way out to get rid of frivolous cases. But after serious cases come...
Before any of the Texas proceedings had taken place, your client filed his 1983 action, and the judge was asked to give a deposition and said he had cases set for all week and all the next week, and your client said, well, I plan that the deposition is going to last at least 2 weeks, so you better adjourn that calendar. And the federal judge said, you're going to have to participate in these depositions, and if it takes 2 weeks, it takes 2 weeks.
Well, Your Honor, number one, judges are amenable to subpoena and to testimony in Texas. And we haven't had any problem with it in Texas. The rules of procedure give uh, a, ample opportunity for any witness to be protected from harassment, and that would certainly be doubly true with respect to judges. Now, that's number one. Now, number two is it doesn't apply to this case, but because we don't have to have Judge Correa's testimony in this case.
But certainly the Fifth Circuit en banc opinion would include many cases in which you did need the testimony of the judge.
Yes, that I would say that they discussed that question, and they said the inconvenience to the judges would be relatively insignificant when you compare the disadvantages of not having this rule, of allowing derivative immunity. So that's the way they dispose of it.
Are there not many situations in which a sitting judge might be subpoenaed and required to spend time in court as a witness, either to an automobile accident or to will that he'd drawn when he was in private practice or even when he was on the bench?
Certainly. The fact that he's a judge doesn't mean that he's not a citizen of the United States and have the obligations of citizenship. If he has knowledge of crime or anything else that's been committed, and he's the only person that can testify, sure he ought to testify.
His immunity is a narrow immunity relating
to
his judicial function.
It's just designed to protect the integrity of the court. Now, when you get down to what the immunity really is after, the end is integrity. Now, independence is only a means. Now, it's an important means. If the judge is not independent, he possibly cannot be entirely fair and impartial and free in his decisions. But if he uses his independence as a means of aiding corruption, as happened in this case, then to say that you exalt the independence of the judge over and above and make it more important than integrity, then you are reversing the whole application. Now,
that argument would undermine the concept of judicial immunity itself.
It would, yes, but the doctrine of judicial immunity is the law.
If
we are free to proceed against those who conspire with the judge and those who corrupted him, you're not completely left out in the cold. Now, I don't think anyone argues that the doctrine of judicial immunity is justified on any basis except to preserve an independent judiciary and the integrity of the courts against fallacious and frivolous charges. And if we're allowed to proceed against those who corrupted the judge, then we're still not completely left out in the cold.
Well, your lawsuit, you say, is not frivolous, and I assume that it isn't. But this rule of law for which you contend would allow frivolous lawsuits.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is there is no way you can keep frivolous lawsuits from being filed in any field.
Well, one way is to decide that the Court of Appeals was mistaken in this case.
Now, I think the Seventh Circuit and the McFarland case probably has laid the groundwork for the proper rule to take care of that. You're going to have frivolous lawsuits unless you have rules of procedure that can take care of them. Now, that question really is not reached in this case. I think you're going to have some stringent rules on cases of this kind, and the Seventh Circuit has said so. And we have pled our case specifically and in great particularity so that it would satisfy the stringent requirements that are made by the Seventh Circuit. And we don't argue with that. We think they ought to have very stringent requirements. I don't think anybody ought to just be able to sit down and think up a bunch of charges to make against a judge and file a suit.
And so long as he includes a private citizen as a co-conspirator, he can sue the private citizen for the judge's action.
You can sue the private citizen, and he's the one. You should be able to get most of your testimony from him without having to go to the judge. But if it is something that the judge feels like he's got an interest in it, he can always.
And no matter how frivolous, any plaintiff can do it.
I didn't say that.
Well, what are these rules set up by the Seventh Circuit? How do you get
out
of them? How do you stop somebody from filing a complaint?
Well, of course, you can't do that.
No.
You can't stop them from filing a complaint, but you can stop them from carrying it on to the point that it becomes a nuisance. The trial judge, I think, can determine
by dealing with the merits of the case.
By dealing with the,
and that's exactly what judicial immunity is supposed to prevent at the outset, nip in the bud. You don't get to the merits of the case because the defendant is immune.
Well, that
cannot
would be right.
Be sued.
That would be right if it was a suit against the judge.
Right.
But this is not a suit against the judge. This is a suit against the people that bribed him. So you don't have that problem. It's just not.
Well, the problem is still there, I suggest.
That issue was faced in the Fifth Circuit, and the requirement of specific pleadings, of course, puts the trial judge in a position to dismiss the case if it isn't pled with particularity and manner to where it overcomes the idea that it is a frivolous lawsuit. That's really not too hard for the trial judge to do.
But a malicious person can plead with particularity.
Absolutely so.
Well, of course, if it is a malicious deal, the defendant has some action against the parties that filed malicious litigation.
Well, so, that hasn't been the way 1983 has worked in the past, is that you get a judgment against the judge, and then he in turn turns around and sues the person who sues him.
Well, of course, the truth of the matter is that the 1983 didn't really function until about the last 20 years.
Back to life.
Yes, it very likely has. The dam broke when they tried the first case, and it's to be expected when anything is held back that long that there's going to be a lot of litigation. But they're being weeded out. I don't think it's that serious. But when you're dealing with a civil case, you're in an entirely different situation than you are with the fellow in the penitentiary that doesn't have anything to do but sit around there and work around in the library and figure out ways he can try to bring a case before the court. You're dealing with people that have been suing in the state court. They've had lawyers involved with it, and they are not. No lawyer is going to get strung out with a judge on a case unless he has valid grounds. I've been practicing law 43 years, and this is the first time I ever had a case.
You haven't been watching the flow of cases in appellate courts either.
I realize that there's been a flow of frivolous cases, and you've had to deal with them. But what I'm saying is, as long as the courts are going to consider the frivolous cases, I don't think they ought to throw my meritorious case out with the bath.
That's what the doctrine of judicial immunity itself does.
It does if we sue the judge. We're not suing the judge.
Yeah, but your argument would undermine the doctrine of judicial immunity itself.
Let me answer that question. In the first place, they say that the judge is not a person, so far as 1983 is concerned. Well, of course, that's a fiction. He is a person. He may be an immune person, but he's a person. And the fact that he is immune does not have anything to do with his capacity to conspire. He has full capacity to conspire. He has full capacity to commit any criminal act that any individual has. And so the idea that he's not a person is just a fiction, not even valid legal fiction. But now, when you get past that, he has conspired, and by virtue of his conspiracy, our clients have been denied their right to try their case before a fair and impartial judge because the case was tried before a bribed judge. Now, that's not what the Constitution guarantees. We're not here arguing with the idea of an independent judiciary. We're here because we didn't get a fair and impartial judge to begin with. Now,
but the rule for which you contend could not be confined to Duval County, Texas. And it would enable any person convicted, for example, of a criminal offense to bring a 1983 lawsuit against the complaining witness in his case and on the claim that the complaining witness conspired with the judge to do him dirt.
The answer to that, Your Honor, is simple. Corruption isn't restricted to Duval County, Texas. I read in the paper the other day some judge up in Ohio, but he'd been removed from office. The corruption they recited in that case looked like it's just as bad as Duval County. But we've got to be able to deal with it when it happens, where it happens. And we cannot use the doctrine of judicial immunity and derivative immunity to provide a cover-up when there is judicial corruption. If there's judicial corruption, that is one place.
Well, if you have judicial corruption on the part of the judge alone, who's not in cahoots with anybody, judicial immunity does provide a cover-up, to use your word.
Frankly, I don't see any way around that. If a judge
is
corrupt by himself.
But if he can... Is there judicial immunity under Texas law?
Yes, sir.
For damage, is it absolute immunity, like similar to what has been announced in 1983 suits?
My opinion is that there hadn't been enough case law on it to answer the question. I think it's...
But to the extent there is, the judges are immune.
I would guess that the Texas courts will come down pretty much the same way you have here.
Well, what about... But you haven't had any third-party cases, then?
No. No derivative immunity at all under Texas law that I know of. I'm sure they haven't had it. But then you get past that and get into derivative immunity. And the cases that have considered it and decided against it begin like this. Number one, the plain language of the statute doesn't provide for derivative immunity because it says any person who...
Or for judicial immunity.
Or for judicial immunity. But judicial immunity has been provided under the theory that it existed at common law. Now, derivative immunity did not exist at common law. So, therefore... the cases that have held that judge is immune.
You mean were there some cases that held that it didn't, or just that there weren't any cases?
That you mean on the common law question? My research has failed to disclose a single case.
All right, so that you really, so there weren't cases that said it didn't exist.
I've had numerous law review articles, and I've seen the quotation in cases and in briefs and so forth. That there was no derivative immunity at common law. Now, I can't cite you a case that says, that specifically says that that is a British case as of the date of the 1983. Now, the next thing is that any such immunity that is awarded to the private individuals who conspire with the judge constitutes an invitation to corruption. That's just engraved into the idea that if you are going to allow a man to become immune from liability, if he can bribe a judge and make him party to the scheme, he automatically gets immune for his act. To pose that question is almost to answer it, I think.
Couldn't we say the same about judicial immunity, that it almost invites a judge to be corrupt?
Right.
Well, of course, I think that is there in our protection, and the only protection we have is that I think we have been very fortunate in the quality of lawyers who have taken the bench as a career. There have been exceptions, of course, and we've been embarrassed by them. The profession has, and the judiciary has.
But official immunity doesn't insulate a judge from either criminal liability, nor from disbarment, or
doesn't
from investigation by, or removal,
or doesn't change his character.
Being reelected.
Doesn't change his character in any way.
Mr. Smith, what's the rationale of the cases that have been against your position and have said that there was a derivative?
Well, the rationale there is substantially what Mr. Edmonds said, that the fact that the we'll take. Simplified, we got two parties, the judge and one party. So the one party who bribes the judge finds out that the judge is immune, and then you file your conspiracy suit on 1983, and you cannot have a conspiracy with only one party. So with the judge removed, they say, well, he didn't conspire with any state official against whom you could allege a cause of action. Well, of course, that's a fiction. He conspired with him. As in this case, the injunction was issued as a result of the bribe. It lasted for 31 months. Our client abated. He abated because it had the force of state law. It was state action. It had the color of state law. Everything that was acquired was there. And he abated for 31 months. And the trial that he had was before a judge that was bribed. Now, that doesn't meet the standard that the Constitution guarantees.
I don't think I... understand yet what the rationale is of these cases.
Well, the rationale was that because it takes two to conspire, when you remove the state, the immune state officer, you just have one left. Therefore, there was no conspiracy because you can't conspire with yourself.
Isn't there more than that?
Yes.
The discouragement of frivolous lawsuits, for one thing, and
well,
secondly,
of course that, that's
the impingement
in
by
too.
Federal
yes,
courts
yes,
on state judicial processes and
yes,
the like.
Sir. That's right. That's right.
And aren't those expressed in some of the other yeah. opinions
those,
against you?
Those matters are expressed, yes, sir. Yes, the yes, opinions sir. Do, the opinions that do sustain it do point out that there would be frivolous lawsuits, but... my position is that we've had those frivolous lawsuits, and we haven't had derivative immunity up until now. So I think you can allow a suit under 1983 when it's meritorious, and if you follow the pleading requirements of the Seventh Circuit, you're going to almost be sure that it's meritorious before you get to the discovery end of it. I beg pardon?
So long as the pleader told the truth.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But, of course, you've got...
Even that, is it, Mr. Smith? If the, even if it's a frivolous lawsuit and the judge isn't a defendant, he can get out. It isn't that much of a burden on him. The fact that somebody who alleged to have bribed him is being sued.
It's no burden at all to the judge because he does get loose. But... I think any frivolous lawsuit certainly would be disposed of because before they haul a judge off his bench and tie him up for 2 weeks in testimony, I just can't see a federal district judge allowing that to happen under the rules that allow protection against that sort of harassment. I think to bring a state judge off his bench, I think the federal judge would have to be convinced that there's some merit to this case. And of course, the judge would have
a degree of immunity from being hauled into the case.
Well, certainly, I think any witness has protection against harassment.
But you don't think the judge would have any more than anybody else?
I think he would have more because I think
he would have more.
I think he would have more. I think the courts would allow him more. I think they would recognize. That the judge, because of his responsibilities to the public, that they just can't haul him off of the bench and tie him up for 2 weeks. I think the courts would consider that.
Your colleague suggests that he couldn't be called at all.
Well, that would that would be his position and his preference, I'm sure. But the
Mr. Smith, you'd say it would be available even if it was an accident case. Judge was a witness. You'd say the federal judge isn't going to drag him off the bench and inconvenience him unnecessarily. That's all you're saying there, isn't it?
Isn't there a parallel, Mr. Smith, with many of the suits against cabinet officers? Now, under the new statutes, a cabinet officer may be sued in any federal jurisdiction in the country, and including Hawaii and Alaska. And haven't the courts... seen to it that their testimony can be taken by deposition, by interrogatory, and not drag them away from their cabinet work?
I think those orders of protection could be given in judicial cases. I think the rules are more lax with respect to executive officers and those who have what they call a limited immunity. You see, a lot of these public officers have a limited immunity. But the courts still protect them. They don't allow them to just be taken away from their jobs. They can make them take the deposition by written interrogatories.
Of course, a judge doesn't have any immunity at all for conduct that occurs outside of his judicial office. I mean, if a judge hits you with his automobile in some afternoon, he's not immune at all, any more than any other negligent driver is.
Well, that's right. It's when he gets on the bench in response. Of course, we don't know where this bribe was given, whether it was out on the ranch or out in town in the cafe in the coffee shop or whether it was in chambers. But it was what he did was when he got on the bench and entered the wrongful injunction in response to that.
And he clearly had the authority to enter an injunction.
He has authority to enter an injunction. I think the appellate court ruled that he abused his discretion in entering this particular injunction because it wasn't pled for, number one, and they could have the suit asked for an injunction against pollution. They alleged that they were operating the wells in a manner to pollute the surface of the land. But the surface of the land in this case wasn't owned by the petitioner. But the The injunction could have enjoined pollution, but under Texas law, there's no way they could have enjoined him from the lawful operation of producing oil. They could have enjoined him from pollution, but not from operating their property. And that's where it was fatally defective, and that's why the appellate courts ruled that it was an abuse of discretion that he entered it. And, of course, he entered it without taking any evidence to speak of. He just practically on the pleading. But those are in the case. That's really not too much involved here, but that's what the background is. But anyway, extension of immunity to private parties is simply not necessary to preserving the integrity of the judiciary, as I see it. And that's what the courts have observed that have taken our position in the case. The courts that have taken opposite position has, as it's been noticed, talked about these frivolous lawsuits. We don't deny that frivolous lawsuits are going to be filed. They're going to be filed whether or not you allow a suit when you have a meritorious lawsuit. But we think the meritorious should be allowed, certainly, if you're going to hear all these frivolous cases. Now, and as observed by the Fifth Circuit, there's very little inconvenience to the judge, and it's relatively insignificant when you compare it with the benefits to be derived by allowing suits under general immunity. Now, with respect to the state court case, there is a case pending. I think I should explain that since it has been mentioned. When this case was filed, Judge Greer was still sitting as judge of the court in Duval County. As it was proceeding, we realized we had a more serious question here on this matter of judicial immunity than we thought when we started out. Frankly, my mind at the beginning just couldn't conceive of a holding that a judge could accept a bribe and he not be immune, and certainly that he'd confer that immunity to the other parties. I couldn't grasp that.
Your time has expired now, Mr. Smith.
But that's substantial in our case. That case in court and state court was mainly protective.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Edmonds?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may take a few minutes to respond to several matters that have been raised. Mr. Smith makes the statement in his argument that his client is left out in the cold. Again, I think this consideration is critical when we talk about the rationale for this statute. The rationale of Congress in implementing this, in passing this statute to implement the 14th Amendment. Judge Carrillo did enter this injunction, but that injunction, in the course of the procedures and the substantive law that exists in the state of Texas, that injunction was set aside by a Texas court. Sparks and Lynn, Mr. Smith's clients, did not have to go to federal court to get the Texas courts to do right. The Texas courts resolved the question. He was not left out in the cold. Secondly, they're not left out in the cold because they have pending a lawsuit in Texas courts under Texas law for the wrongful injunction.
Yes, I know, but they say that's a briar patch down in Duval County, that they can't get justice.
Well, part of that lawsuit is pending in Nueces County, Your Honor, as was pointed out in our brief. Part of that lawsuit under the Texas venue procedure, the lawsuit as it applies to my client, Mr. Dennis, is pending in Nueces County, yes, Your Honor, which I submit is not a hornet's nest in Texas.
Briar patch is their phrase.
Or briar patch.
Edmonds, if you had four conspirators here, alleged conspirators, rather than just one and the judge, but one of the four was a state judge, would you still be here?
If one of the four was a state judge?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's...
So that his immunity applies to all the other conspirators, not just a single one. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, that's the situation we have here.
Well, what if the plaintiffs in a lawsuit file a lawsuit against your clients and they claim the immunity, and your clients come in and claim immunity based on the immunity of a state judge? And the answer of the plaintiffs is, we stipulate that we'll never bother that judge. We'll never call him as a witness. He'll never be a witness against any of you. We'll not bother him at all. But we'd have to admit that in the course of our lawsuit, we're going to try to prove that he was corrupt. Now, would you think your claim of immunity would be satisfied by any stipulation like that?
The public interest behind judicial immunity would definitely not be satisfied.
Why? Why not?
Your statement that in the course of these proceedings, we're going to prove that there was a conspiracy for this judge to do wrong.
Right.
That's the very essence of judicial immunity, the very essence of it. And my man is raising that immunity not because he's a judge, but because of this court's decision in Pearson v. Ray that judicial immunity is applicable in 1983, despite the fact there's nothing said in that statute about judicial immunity or any immunity.
Well, do you think that the public interest rationale is meant to kind of put up a facade to the public that all judges are much more honest than normal people?
To use Mr. Smith's term, I guess that would be a fiction that we'd be dealing with, Your Honor. I don't think that the purpose of immunity is to create a fiction. I think the purpose of this immunity that goes back to the King's Bench hundreds of years ago is that there's this presumption that it does exist. And if we wanted to opine that what if we get into a situation where the majority of judges are corrupt,
well, the public interest
then perhaps public interest would be changed.
The public interest rationale certainly doesn't prevent the filing of a complaint.
No.
Which may get great publicity in the papers as to what the claims are about what some judge did. And despite any stipulation or the immunity of the judge from being called as a witness, there it is. And if the case goes forward against him and there's a judgment against the plaintiffs, namely that the that nobody did anything wrong, well, the judge is going to be vindicated, I suppose.
Yes,
and if the finding is that the conspirators really did conspire with the judge, doesn't add a whole.
Just the mere fact of filing the law, or the ability to file the lawsuit.
Well, I know, but that the immunity doesn't protect anybody
right.
from that.
That's right, and I have to submit to the court that this isn't as easy a question to answer as Mr. Smith submits. We're not trying to say that there's a black and white side to this.
Well,
it's a matter of balancing.
Even with the explicit, very explicit immunity and protection of the speech or debate clause, a member of Congress can be sued under 1983 or in many other ways, and that doesn't stop that exposure.
No, but he's immune if the conduct for which he was sued falls under the speech or debate clause.
He isn't immune from having someone file a complaint with a lot of scurrilous allegations.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. We're not talking here about should the scope of judicial immunity be broad enough to somehow screen out lawsuits as they're being filed at the clerk's house.
Couldn't do it.
No. I guess the answer there is to depend upon responsible journalism, that they don't blow a lawsuit like that out of proportion when it's filed before it's adjudicated. Under the respondent's view of 1983 and the ability to pursue conspirators, these private citizens, I submit that to follow the respondent's view of the case, that the respondent could have gone to federal court immediately at the time that Judge Carrillo entered the temporary injunction, even before the Beaumont Court of Appeals in Texas had a chance to throw it out. Mr. Smith is fortunate in that he can present to the court such a bad set of facts.
Well, he would have a very big trouble doing that in the face of the Anti-Injunction Act and a few other things.
Under 1983, if We have a conspiracy, and if the immunity of that judge does not in effect shield the judicial proceeding.
Well, you wouldn't be enjoining the judge or the judicial proceeding.
No, I'm saying that he could sue.
Well, you mean for damages? He could probably enjoin the conspirators from continuing to bribe the judge.
Well, Your Honor, this bribery—that's Mr. Smith's term.
That would be enjoining the crime. You can't
enjoin the crime. Well, maybe I didn't state myself clearly. What I was stating that under the respondent's view of the case, that just after the trial court stage, that he would be entitled under Section 1983 to file a suit for damages in federal court, despite what might happen in state court.
What you say is that in any court action where there's more than one defendant and one of the defendants is an immune judge, all of the others are equally immune. Isn't that what you say?
If it's a suit under a civil action suit.
If it's a suit, 1983 or anything else.
And if it's based upon the judge's conduct as a judge.
If it has more than one person involved, and one of the people is a judge, all of the others, 1, 2, or 87, are all immune.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor. And that the reason is...
You notice I didn't ask you for any support.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as the fiction concerning whether a judge... Given this court's decisions that judicial immunity is applicable in 1983 cases, to say that a judge is or isn't a person is a fiction. That one could almost say that judicial immunity itself is a fiction when it comes to applying that to 1983. I just submit that it was not the Congress's intent to litigate in federal court all state court civil proceedings.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in PEPCO.